The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, greetings, America, and welcome to Capital Thinking. I hope you have the air conditioning on and are somewhere cool as we continue to get baked here on the East Coast by record high temperatures. We've got another eclectic and interesting show for you today here on Capital Thinking. We're going to start with talking about a lack of services for families with dying children, a very interesting topic. And then we're going to move on to talk about historic preservation rights with some folks very engaged in that topic. In the second half of the hour, we'll talk about Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan, her nomination, and the steps it has to go before it gets her on the court in time for the October session. And then we'll wrap up by talking about the current state of the financial reform bill in Congress, what it means for Wall Street and for Main Street. But our first guest and first topic today has to do with a lack of services for families with dying children, and we are joined by Susan Rogers, the Executive Director of the District of Columbia Pediatric Palliative Care Collaboration. She's someone with a great deal of professional experience on a number of critical issues, including end-of-life care, and we're very delighted to have her on board. So, Susan, welcome to the show, and tell us a little bit about who your organization is.
Okay, well, thank you, first of all, for having us today. The District of Columbia Pediatric Palliative Care Collaboration, or what we call the DCPPCC, is a collaboration of two healthcare facilities who came together to share expertise, knowledge, and resources to ensure that children and their families with life-limiting and life-threatening illnesses in the District of Columbia and the metropolitan area receive the care they need, and that care would be pediatric palliative care, so that we can ensure that they get the best quality of life for them and their families.
And tell us a little bit about the history of this organization, how it came to be.
Well, the reason this organization came to be is a colleague of mine, Carlos Gomez, and I. He's a physician. We kept getting calls when we were working for one of the local hospices about children that actually needed this kind of care and that there was no way for them to go home because there were no systems in place. There was a nurse here or a nurse there, but there was nothing that was absolutely in place that you could depend on all the time. So what we saw was a lack of access to care, a lack of education on the part of the professionals, and a lack of financial structures that could help pay for this care. I think a quick short story might be helpful. We had a little boy early on before we start the organization who had one of the rare neurological neuromuscular disorders, and his family desperately wanted to take him home from the hospital, and there was no nurse that was available in the District of Columbia to take this little care for this little boy at home. So what we decided to do was we'd take him into our inpatient unit and care for him there and train the nurse up so that she could see him at home. And unfortunately, the little boy died an hour or two after he got to the unit. And I think that shows that because there was lack of access to care, because there was lack of education on the part of the professionals, and in a sense, the financial structure, why it was so necessary to try to start this program. I want to just say one quick thing about the education, and that is that pediatric palliative care is about 20 to 30 years behind where adult hospice and palliative care is. And so it is not necessarily taught in any of the medical and nursing schools, social work schools, as hospice itself, hospice and palliative care, was not taught for many, many years in the adult realm.
And how big a universe of children in the United States would you estimate need this care at any given time?
Well, we guessed that, well, if we looked at the statistics, there were about 53,000 children that died in the United States in 2007. Now, if you take away from those the ones that were due to traumatic incidences, there's a lot of children. We estimate here in the District of Columbia that there's probably about 1,600 children that could use this type of care. Now, that doesn't mean that when we talk about life limiting and life threatening, that does not necessarily mean a child that's going to die within the next 2 weeks. It could be a child with cystic fibrosis or a congenital anomaly that they need more care than just a curative care, because there is no cure for most of these diseases. So the palliative and the hospice care looks at the symptoms and controls the symptoms. It's total care of the patient and the family. So it looks not only at the physical aspects, but the psychosocial aspects, the spiritual aspects, the entire family, and it cares for the parents, the grandparents, siblings, that sort of thing.
Gotcha. And I imagine it's got to be very specialized training for this. Obviously, a mix of not only medical training, but also the ability to sort of empathetically deal with parents in a parent's worst nightmare situation and a child who's probably confused and frightened at all times that they're being mm-hmm. treated.
And that's the point, is to make that child not confused and frightened and the parent not confused and frightened. One of the things that we're doing, there are some national programs that are addressing just this issue. What we're doing here in Washington, D.C., as the D.C. PPCC, is we have a national conference each year when we bring in the leaders throughout the United States to discuss these issues, such as pain management, communication. This year we are having a specialist just talk about sibling grief. What happens to these little children who are the brothers and sisters of these kids that are dying? So we do that. We have quarterly grand rounds. This year we have coming in from Minnesota one of the gurus in pediatric pain management, and that's Stefan Friedrichsdorf. And there is a 4.5-day program for physicians and nurse practitioners just on symptom management in pediatrics. We also have the videos from our conferences online to help educate people. We do these LNEC programs for nurses twice a year. We do one in Richmond with VCU, and we do one here in the district. Usually we do it at Children's Hospital.
And tell me a little bit about how you go about recruiting the nurses to be involved. I imagine, again, it takes a special person to want to do this kind of specialized care.
Well, here's the thing. I think that there are many people out there that would like to take care of these children. They're just afraid to take care of them because they don't have the training to do it. Either they're a pediatric nurse that doesn't have the palliative piece, or it's a hospice and palliative nurse who doesn't have the pediatric piece. And so that's what we try to do, is look at what the needs are and try to address the needs for that specific group. We also have been doing some training of the certified nursing assistants, who are people that go into the home and take care of the children, sometimes on a daily basis. And we do education for them also. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, well, I think it does. Tell me a little bit about the partnerships that your organization has developed with hospitals and others here in the Washington, D.C. area.
Okay, right now we have two partners, and that's Children's National Medical Center and the PANDA team there, which is their palliative care team, which is an in-hospital palliative service, and the Hospital for Sick Children Pediatric Center. They have the Butterfly team, which is the palliative care team. We are working right now with one hospice in the that does care in the District of Columbia. They're taking children right now in the district on a case-by-case basis, and we are hopeful that by September or even by August that they will be up and fully running a pediatric palliative care service. On the other hand, we are also working with two organizations that do pediatric home care, doing education with them in order to get them up to speed on the palliative piece so that they can also do the care for the children at home. So we are hopeful that by September there will be two home care agencies, a hospice agency. We know that Children's has a palliative care service. We know HSC has a palliative care service. And there are other hospitals in Washington, D.C. with pediatric services that I know that Georgetown is one of the places that is they have a palliative care service for adults and are wanting to have a pediatric palliative care program, but I am not sure when that would
happen. How many kids, if once those are all up and running, how many kids will you all be able to take care of at any given time?
I think I can put it in perspective a little bit better if I say,
please.
In the last 18 months, there were about 94 children that were taken care of by these clinical organizations. I think that we can double that very easily once there are more services up and running. But we project that in the District of Columbia alone, the children that have the disease entities that would fall into this category would be about 1,600.
Wow, it's a pretty significant number here.
Yeah. Then they're not getting that care now.
And I know a lot of listeners will be interested in knowing, how are you all funded? How can people be supportive? And how can they find out more information about what you do?
Okay, well, how we are funded right now is the organizations that are our partners, they donate a certain amount of money each year to help us stay afloat, so to speak. We also have grants there are federal grants, there are local grants from local philanthropies. We also have just started a fundraising program, and it's sort of in its infancy. But if people want more information on how they could help in many different ways, volunteering, by writing a check, by connecting us with people that might be able to help, they can either call 202-895-0191 or info, they can go online to info@dcppcc.org.
I see. Why don't you give us both those numbers again?
Okay. The number to call would be 202-895-0191 or online info@DC, District of Columbia, TP, Patty, CC, Charlie.org.
Great. Well, we have been joined by Susan Rogers with the District of Columbia Pediatric Palliative Care Collaboration. I hope you'll check out more information and support their very noble cause. Back in just a moment.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball,
off the glass,
football,
come on,
golf, racing, or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, everybody, welcome back. We're going to talk a little bit about the unique and challenging policy issue of historic preservation in major cities across the United States today. And we have two great guests with us. We're joined by Ken Bernstein, who's the manager of the City of Los Angeles' Office of Historic Resources, in charge of that city's historic preservation policies. And he's got a long career working for a variety of interests and cities and outside groups on not-for-profit historic preservation issues. Joining him is Catherine Buell. Catherine is an attorney, a real estate attorney in Washington, D.C., and she has recently been appointed the head of that city's historic preservation board. So welcome to both of you, and delighted to have you here on the show for the first time. Ken, we're going to start with you and ask tell us a little bit about Los Angeles, where I know there's a very ambitious citywide survey of historic resources going on there. I know a lot of people aren't aware that the city of Los Angeles is actually, by size, physical size, one of the largest cities at well over 400 square miles. So tell us a little bit about your survey and what it might mean for others nationwide.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you. And you know, for your listeners around the country, I think many don't think of Los Angeles as a city that has significant architectural heritage and rich historic resources. But although we are a comparatively younger city, as compared with some East Coast cities, we really do have a tremendous architectural heritage of wonderful Art Deco architecture, great, very intact historic downtown, great movie palaces, and really wonderful historic neighborhoods that are often off the beaten path somewhat in Los Angeles. So we have, our Office of Historic Resources was formed in great part to do a first ever inventory of our historic resources in Los Angeles. All the work that's been done previously here has really only looked at about 15% of the city, and we're a city of over 465 square miles. So we've created a program we call Survey LA, which is the Los Angeles Historic Resources Survey, and we're very fortunate to have the partnership of the Getty, a home institution here in Los Angeles. We have the Getty Museum, but the Getty also has a foundation which has given the city a multi-year grant to conduct this survey, and it's really that basic building block, the foundation of our historic preservation program, was we can only begin to preserve what's significant in our city if we know what we have, what's out there in the first place. And so we're really building a kind of state-of-the-art survey tool that we think is transferable to other cities, to D.C. and other cities around the country, using new technology. The survey will be conducted using tablet PCs by professional survey consultants out in the field. We have a very extensive public participation program that allows community members to contribute information and ideas and their thoughts of what's significant in their own communities into the survey process. All of this is going to be available and searchable on the web, on our website, which is at surveyla.org. And we are now, after completing pilot surveys for this project, we're now underway, and actually this coming week we'll be sending survey teams out in three major community plan areas of our city to begin the survey field work, which will be continuing over the next 3 years.
Nice. Well, let me turn to you, Catherine, newly appointed head of the District of Columbia's Historic Preservation Review Board, and that's an entity that some folks in the media have actually compared to the Supreme Court. I'm not going to ask you which Supreme Court justice that makes you, but tell us a little bit about the Historic Preservation Review Board and what role it plays in a city like the District of Columbia, which, unlike Los Angeles, people would think the District of Columbia is full of historical properties, just knowing that it's the capital city.
That's right. And we're very different from the city of Los Angeles because we're only 10 square miles, but we have 500 historic landmarks, have 46 historic districts, and in terms of the dollar value of the projects that we're reviewing, it's about half of the development that comes in the city. We actually review those projects. So we review the largest real estate development projects in the city. And this includes the Department of Homeland Security's headquarter development, which is a $3.4 billion project. So the reason people compare us to the Supreme Court is because we have so much influence, both in the neighborhood side but also in the large-scale development side.
Let's talk about how you use some of that influence, Catherine. Sustainable development, smart growth, those are big things that local planning agencies and cities nationwide deal with more and more. How does that impact historic preservation as you do planning in a place like the District of Columbia?
Well, in the district, what we'd like to focus on is our neighborhood development. And a lot of the initiatives that the Office of Planning has taken has focused on smart growth development, live, work, play, neighborhood development. And historic preservation is at the core of that. And so what we've really been pushing from the Historic Preservation Office's side is to make sure that we're not only part of the conversation, but people recognize that the green buildings in our historic districts are the basis for the sustainable development in the District of Columbia.
Let me come back to you, Ken, and ask sort of the same question. Is it possible to be preserving these historic buildings while at the same time promoting economic development or economic recovery in these cities?
Oh, absolutely. Historic preservation really is an economic development tool. And while I think at times preservationists and historic preservation itself have the unfortunate reputation as being standing in the way of change, in fact, just the opposite is true. Historic preservation is really a way of managing change and deciding what type of change is appropriate. And preservation is very much at the heart of most of our nation's vibrant economic development and revitalization programs. If you think about cities we admire around the country for having economic vitality, whether it's downtowns in areas such as Chicago or Boston or D.C., historic southern cities like Charleston or Savannah, historic preservation has been at the heart of the revitalization of those communities, as well as in historic main streets in small and medium-sized cities around the country. So I think sophisticated developers and economic development planners around the country no longer see preservation and economic development as competing, but really see preservation as a economic revitalization tool.
And when we talk about property rights, you must have a lot of property rights advocates who aren't happy that the government is telling them what they can and can't do with historic property, and I'd like to get your opinion on how you deal with that.
Well, we do deal with that all the time because, like Catherine, I and our office, we are the professional staff to our Cultural Heritage Commission, which designates local landmarks in the city of Los Angeles. We have 25 historic districts, what we call historic preservation overlay zones in Los Angeles. So when we have public hearings, that is how the testimony breaks down. We often have supporters of preservation and then sometimes opponents who raise these property rights arguments. And ultimately, it is a balancing act, and we need to make certain, first of all, that our historic preservation laws are being interpreted in a way that's balanced and even-handed and respectful of private property rights, and that we take input and testimony from private property owners. But we often do make the point as well that historic preservation laws don't infringe on property rights any more than other types of laws and rules that have long been accepted. Everybody says, my home is my castle, I can do what I want with it. But that really isn't the reality in terms of our legal framework in the United States. We all have in our cities, and most of our cities, zoning laws that prevent you from replacing a single family home with a five-story vertical mansion in a single family area, and can't put a landfill or skyscraper next to a single family home. Historic preservation laws are very much the same. It's a way of ensuring that your neighboring property owner respects the property rights that you have on your property, and that there's a balance between the rights of the individual and the rights of the collective, an understanding that preservation is a way of protecting property values in many cases. Because
let me come back to you, Catherine, and ask you sort of the same question again. I know in the district, having read the Washington Post on a regular basis, you see some neighborhoods that are unhappy with designations made for particular pieces of property. How do you deal with that, and how does that impact future development in D.C., a city where Mayor Fenty is, you know, very focused on attracting new business to town?
That's right, and I was listening to Ken and nodding vigorously, because one of the words that he used is revitalization. The District of Columbia has implemented a historic homeowner grant program where they have given $1.6 million to low to moderate income homeowners to renovate the facades of their homes. And this is so that people who don't necessarily have the money to invest in their property can. And they started it out on a pilot basis in one neighborhood that had seen some neglect for a number of years. And literally the neighborhood has come back to life. So historic preservation, what we've seen, has become a really cool thing. It's become something that other people want, and they want to understand why they're not in a historic. And I think focusing on revitalization and the benefits of historic preservation as we have this discussion is really important for all of us.
Well, and I've got about 90 seconds left, Catherine. Let me end with you and ask you, if you're a real estate developer, why is historic preservation important?
I think that historic preservation adds quality and to your project, not only to what you're working on, but to the surrounding development. And it's important just to protect your investment.
Ken, let me come back to you. Anything to add on that?
Well, I think we have sophisticated real estate developers who are making money doing historic, at least until recently with the real estate collapse, but in recent years we're making money doing adaptive reuse, converting historic bank buildings and commercial buildings to housing and to new uses. And we've seen in our 25 historic districts that those are appreciating in value at a greater rate than surrounding neighborhoods that don't have the historic designation. So property owners and developers now understand that historic preservation makes good economic sense.
All right. Well, we've been joined by Ken Bernstein from the City of Los Angeles' Office of Historic Resources and Catherine Buell, the new head of the District of Columbia's Historic Preservation Board. And we're going to be back in just a minute to talk about Elena Kagan and her pending nomination to the Supreme Court.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjoy Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjoy Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola. Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Makaba.
From Denver to Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Well, last week was the spectacle of watching Elena Kagan before the Senate Judiciary Committee for her confirmation hearing, and we've got two distinguished guests on with us to talk about the results of that hearing and next steps. From American University, we have law professor Steve Vladek, and from the halls of Washington Power, we have Nick Allard, one of the D.C.'s leading lobbyists. And before we get going, we'll congratulate Nick, who the National Law Journal just recently recognized with their Visionary Award for his work in defense of the lobbying industry. So, Nick, congratulations to you on that. And we'll start with you to ask you what, if anything, actually happened last week to move the needle on this nomination.
Well, she's going to be confirmed, and I think that that took some of the air out of the what are increasingly flat proceedings. So in that sense, there weren't any major mistakes, there weren't any major revelations, and it's a certain march towards her confirmation, as it should be, because she's highly qualified, and, you know, elections have consequences, and the president gets to pick. There was more than conventional wisdom might have that was learned in that hearing. I'm sure Steve has some insights, but you did, I think, see her personality and able to judge how she might interact in a collegial way with eight other colleagues on the court. Also, you know, in some areas, she did indicate, you know, some inklings of a philosophy, you know, on the Commerce Clause, on individual rights and liberties and so on, and in some other areas. So it wasn't completely devoid of substance. I mean, she's obviously made it clear that she's not a strict original intent kind of person when it comes to the Constitution, and that she views the Constitution as a evolving concept, that the document itself doesn't change, the words don't change, but that, you know, applying it to new facts and new circumstances requires an evolution. So, you know, there was some significant insights into, in broad strokes, her judicial philosophy. Very interesting. Of course, she did quite well, and you can expect her, I think, to be colorful and collegial with her colleagues and not a bore.
Well, let me turn to you, Professor, and ask, did we discern an identifiable judicial philosophy out of the remarks she made in the committee last week?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, I agree with Nick's assessment of the hearing. I think it went, you know, the way that most people thought it would. I don't think she's a big surprise. I think, you know, everyone has the same idea, which is that she's, you know, going to have a philosophy that's more like the more Democratic justices on the court right now than the more Republican justices. You know, I think the real question is, what does this process say about, you know, future Supreme Court confirmations? And my real concern is not with this process, and it's not with Elena Kagan, but with the extent to which, you know, we're left to do exactly what Nick was suggesting, which is read very, very small tea leaves to try to get a read on the folks who are going to be the next generation of Supreme Court justices. I think that's unfortunate. You know, I think it's regrettable that these aren't better opportunities to have serious national conversations about who we look for and what we look for in the next Supreme Court justice.
Yeah, we've almost reached an extreme where, you know, the folks running for political office want to tell us everything they want to do, and the people nominated the Supreme Court try their best to tell us nothing about who they are and what they would do other than a very carefully tailored life story of, you know, Horatio Alger up from our bootstraps story. Nick, what do you think it says about sort of the future nominations? If, you know, President Obama gets another nomination, has anything about this process changed who he would pick a third time around and how that person would be considered?
Well, first, I think the point that you both just made is very apt, and it's in spades here with her because she doesn't have a body of judicial decisions that you can review to look at. And her publications, you know, are not necessarily that great or broad, and you know, we're left looking at some memos that she wrote advising the president, you know, when she was a top policy person. So it's almost as if her prospects are enhanced by the lack of a paper record, in some sense. Also, you know, this is an era. Now, she clerked with Abner Mikva, who is a real political, able judge, longtime congressman, and clerked with Thurgood Marshall, the legendary Thurgood Marshall. And having just seen Thurgood, the play, which I commend to everybody, and being able to talk about it with his son after the play, you're struck by the fact that Thurgood Marshall, as legendary and giant of a man as he was a human being with all sorts of warts and histories and jail time, and some of it, you know, probably most of it was, you know, in the furtherance of his you know, work as a civil rights leader and civil rights lawyer. But you know, remarkable to wonder that in this day and age would Thurgood Marshall have been confirmable, even though we've sort of passed beyond the racial Rubicon that would have made it, you know, did make it so much harder earlier on. Now, what does it mean for the future? Well, I'm hopeful that I'm an optimist. You know this, Kevin, because you know me well. I'm hopeful that what we've seen, and that there's a bright side, a silver lining to the yawning that's going on over the last couple of confirmation hearings, something that she wrote about herself in the 90s about, you know, how pointless some of the hearings are. I'm hopeful that we get back to a situation where the president is going to be nominating people who are highly qualified for the position and that there is deference is given to the president's choice and that the advise and consent function focuses on the qualifications and doesn't try to amount to nothing more than political grandstanding, litmus testing, and trying to find, you know, some thread to pull out to have the whole fabric of the confirmation collapse.
Well, let me ask you about that, Professor. It does seem as if the standard has evolved. You know, some people say it goes back to Bork. Republicans will tell you, you know, they took great notice when Chuck Schumer said before the Roberts hearings that, of course, you would consider judicial ideology in casting your votes. And you know, a large number of Democrats didn't vote for Roberts, and even more didn't vote for Alito. And there's lots of talk now that Kagan won't even get the Republican support that Sotomayor enjoyed a year ago. Yet there are many in the Senate who remember Scalia passing. I forget what the margin was, but I want to say it was something around 90-10.
It was even wider than that. It was 98-0.
98-0. Well, that's, you know, that's pretty darn good. It's hard to imagine that Scalia could get nominated today in this environment and maybe get confirmed. This seems like the standard is now you'll get confirmed, but the opposing party will almost lockstep a vote against you just because of the philosophy. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, and that, I mean, that goes back to the point Nick made earlier about how this is what happens when you win, or in the case of the Republicans, lose elections. The voting to me actually, I think, is better today. I mean, I think we've come a long way from the 98 to nothings of the Scalia or, you know, equally lefty justices of generations ago. It's not, I don't mind if people vote against justices because they disagree with them. My concern is that the American people, you know, the folks who don't spend every day trying to read every little scrap that these folks have ever written, don't get a sense of why, right, that this is really just theater. And so, you know, the vote on Kagan could end up being 58-41 or 57-42 without having had any serious conversation about why the vote is close, about what the basis for opposition is other than that she isn't one of us. And so I think that's the frustrating part. It's not the vote. It's the lack of significant discourse. It's the lack of a conversation. It's the lack of any attempt to actually have a public debate over competing judicial philosophies, over views on constitutional interpretation, over views of what makes a good Supreme Court justice. And I think that's, to me, as a constitutional law professor, what is so troubling about how the process has evolved.
Yeah, being a lawyer myself, I was interested. Tom Coburn was trying to get Kagan to talk a little bit about whether or not the health care law was legal or not under the Commerce Clause, and I believe he was using obesity as an example. But, you know, even on broad questions like that, you can't really seem to get an answer out of nominees anymore about what they actually believe the First Amendment means, or what they believe the Commerce Clause means, or does the Tenth Amendment truly have any effect. And
Kevin, you know, I'd actually, it's Nick, take some little bit of issue with you, because I think on precisely on the Commerce Clause, that she indicated that she was supportive of broad deference to the Congress in enacting laws. You know, they tried to trip her up and come up with examples of bad laws or laws where Congress had, you know, nothing to say about it, or agencies didn't have any responsibility, federal agencies, and she wouldn't bite. And
well, I think they were trying to get her to
demonstrated that she would be very deferential to the Congress and have sweeping commerce clause. That's not so much a partisan issue; it's just a philosophy. You know, one of the things we haven't talked about is that there's some other major Judiciary Committee confirmable appointments coming up that are very critical in this area that have been deferred and awaiting this confirmation. And that's for Solicitor General, obviously, which is now vacant, but also the very sort of inside the beltway, but very controversial because of the Bush administration's tenure over the Office of Legal Counsel, which I think has been empty or filled by an acting person for several years.
That's right, because Don Johnson could not get confirmed.
Right, and those are... And, you know, it's one of the questions is there's a lot of highly qualified people, some who are currently in the administration, either in the White House or the judicial, in the Justice Department, for both of those posts, but query whether if those people are put up, whether then they have, you know, there might be more of a firestone over those confirmations, ironically, than for the Kagan confirmation hearings.
Well, and I would add to that the pending confirmation of Goodwin Liu to the Ninth Circuit, who is probably the most, you know, lefty judicial nominee that we've seen from the current administration.
Right.
No, well, you know, yeah, so, Professor, I mean, you're talking about a couple of your colleagues, of course, Don Johnson, who couldn't get out of Indiana School of Law, couldn't get that position at the OLC, the Office of Legal Counsel, and Goodwin, who I believe is at Berkeley, is that right, on the West Coast as a professor, who's gotten
And who's been voted out of the committee. I mean, you know, his nomination is now pending before the full Senate.
And he'll have a tough time. Republicans certainly, in election season, are likely to use him as a symbol of judicial excess, given his writings. And Democrats will say, just as Nick said earlier, that elections have consequences, and the president is entitled to who he wants in this position. Nick, I want you to know I put your name in for Solicitor General. I think you'd look great in a morning coat up there in front of the justices. And Professor and Nick, we would love to have you guys back. We're going to have to wrap up this segment. We'll see when Kagan gets to the floor later this month, if that gives us an opportunity to bring you back.
Thanks very much. Anytime.
Thanks, Kevin.
the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, well, the complex issue of financial regulation and the reform legislation pending in Congress is something we spent a lot of time talking about here on the show. We're joined by one of our regulars who discusses that issue with us, Micah Green, who's one of the leading financial services public policy professionals in Washington, D.C. We're also joined by Pat Garofalo, who's an economics researcher and blogger for wonkroom.org. That's part of the Center for American Progress Action Fund, and he also writes extensively on a number of different publications. Pat, welcome to the show. And, Michael, let me start with you. We were talking offline here before we started about West Virginia. This bill, the conference report has passed the House. It's pending in the Senate. Tell us a little bit about why it hasn't gotten out of the Senate yet and when it might do so.
Well, when the House and Senate adjourned for the 4th of July break, the Senate made the conscious decision that they wanted to wait until after the break to take up this legislation. They felt that a couple things could happen over the break. Some of the Republicans who had indicated some hesitation about parts of the bill were going to look at the final bill, particularly with changes in the fee structure, and potentially decide to support the legislation. That would also give more time for the governor of West Virginia to appoint a replacement for Senator Byrd, who passed away a little over a week ago. And so far, it doesn't look like there will be a replacement for Senator Byrd in place by the time the Congress comes back next week. Right now, the governor has indicated he wants a more formal ruling from the Attorney General's office, what his options are. So that leaves 58 Democratic votes in the Senate, and you need 60 to proceed on this. One Republican has already agreed to support the legislation, and that's Susan Collins. There were three other Republicans who voted for the bill when the bill passed the Senate. One was Senator Olympia Snowe, the others Senator Scott Brown and Senator Chuck Grassley from Iowa. There's really no reason why any Republican who voted for the Senate bill would find objection to the conference agreement on the substantive policy issues. The one objection that seems to be raising itself is the $19 billion fee structure, which originally came out of the conference committee as a bank tax, which was then moderated last week to be much more of a using unspent TARP money and basically ending the TARP program early and providing an adjustment on the FDIC assessments. If that new revenue source seems appropriate for those remaining three Republican senators, it's hard to understand why they would support a harsher, probably more onerous regulatory reform bill in the Senate-passed version and not support the conference agreement.
Pat, let me shift to you and ask, you obviously work for a group on the left side of the political spectrum that pushed very hard for this bill and for some particular items. And talk to me about, is there a general sense of accomplishment and appreciation for some of the provisions that are in there regarding, say, consumer protection or derivative regulation?
I think there is, yes. While the bill isn't what I would have written, I don't know that it's what any of my colleagues would have written either. There are some unfortunate compromises that were made at the 12th hour that I would prefer to see scrapped. But on the whole, I think it's a good step towards building a financial system that's stabler, that's more fair, and starting to get back to some of the principles that kept the financial system together for a long time post-New Deal. On the consumer protection part, I think having a new agency, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, as it's called, is a good thing to have. Right now, the way the regulatory structure is designed, there's no one explicitly looking out for consumers and saying, hey, that financial product, while it may make you a lot of money, you're really ripping people off, and is there a way you can moderate that? I think that was sorely lacking. The Fed isn't going to do it. The bank regulators aren't going to do it. So I think it's appropriate to have a regulator that's going to do it.
And on derivatives?
Derivatives is actually my favorite part of the bill. The derivatives title was designed by was written by Senator Blanche Lincoln, and this is a huge market, totally unregulated. And her principle was that we're going to take these instruments and we're going to put them on public exchanges so that people know what's going on, and we're going to put them through clearing houses so that the parties involved, it's ensured that the parties involved have adequate collateral. I was actually really worried about this when I heard it was Blanche Lincoln who's going to be designing this, because she's a more conservative lawmaker, but I really can't complain much about the final product that she produced.
I'm officially worried about you, Pat, when you cite that you have a favorite part of a 1,000-page bill. Perhaps you need to get a better hobby.
Well, and Kevin, it's Micah. I think hearing Pat say that, I mean, that's an area of the bill that I worked quite a bit on behalf of various types of clients. And I do think they tried to ensure that it had teeth, that it was consistent with the principle of oversight and transparency. And frankly, I think it's one that is tough and really does change the way people do business. But I also think that even the people in the business side believe it's a way, you know, that the derivatives marketplace can continue to provide a legitimate tool for risk management and hedging of risks in a more transparent environment. So maybe the proper balance has been reached.
Micah, tell me a little bit about what Wall Street sort of fears in the implementation stage of the bill, knowing that it's going to pass the Senate sometime in the next few weeks.
Well, it's not even an implementation stage. If you look at those 2,400 pages, there are lots of what I would call fairly significant policy decisions that have been left to the regulatory community to decide. So, you know, beyond just doing the act of producing, implementing regulations, there's some very big policy decisions that still have to be made at the regulatory level. And the regulatory decision-making process is not all that clean, because in many areas, the derivatives area and other areas, systemic risk and resolution authority and whatnot, there has to be clear coordination between multiple regulators. That's why the regulators, for the most part, have been given a year to produce the regulations, and in some cases, longer. And that process leads to right now, people analyzing the bill, trying to figure out how it affects their business precisely, are coming to the conclusion that it will really depend how the regulators interpret some of the issues that the Congress left for them to decide.
Pat, I think there was something like 68 studies that need to be done in order to implement this bill.
Yeah.
So that's an excellent point. There's a ton of work still to be done.
And Pat, real fast, is there anything that you fear that's in the bill that won't get adequately implemented?
I think the Volcker rule is going to be interesting to see what they define as proprietary trading and what they don't. I wouldn't say worried is the correct term, but trying to divvy out. Even Volcker himself, when asked what proprietary trading is, had a hard time saying exactly what it was. He said, you'll know it when you see it. So I think it'll be interesting to see how that rule is ultimately crafted and implemented and what it means to the biggest banks.
And I would add to that, it's not clear what a non-financial, systemically important institution is that would come under the Volcker rule, which really does broaden its reach. So those are two perfect examples of where the regulators have vast authority to decide these issues.
Well, terrific. We're going to leave it there. We were joined by Pat Garofalo, a blogger for wonkroom.org at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, and Micah Green, one of the leading financial services public policy professionals here in Washington, D.C. We're going to be back next Thursday with more here on Capital Thinking.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.